So, okay. I should say that this, the subject is hard for me, personally, because my thesis was about this. So I used to know it really, really well, but I got really far from it. And in fact, the last time I spoke about it was 12 years ago. So it's somehow, on one hand, I feel uncomfortable because it has to be completely trivial for me. On the other hand, it isn't. Anyway, so I'll do my best. So let me remind you where we were. So we were talking about gauge theory in the simplest case. So I know it should be simplest, but it's even simpler than that. And I said I will first go through the formulas and then say something about interpretation. So here are the formulas. They were on the board last time, and I want to go through them again, and only then speak philosophy a little bit. So the situation, okay, the general situation in which people talk about gauge theory is where you have a manifold and above it a vector bundle. But, and you know, once you have a vector bundle, you have various associated bundles, so the bundle of automorphisms of that bundle and so on. But I'll do the simplest case, which is when the bundle is trivial. So really, I just have one vector space and the product of the vector space with M and the projection to M. And then I define two groups. So generally, they will be arbitrarily groups. But this time, I'm only looking about the automorphisms of the fiber. So I'll call this group G. And it's really GLN if V is an n-dimensional vector space. Okay. And likewise, let Gothic G be, well, if you don't know, this is Gothic G according in my handwriting. Okay. This is the endomorphisms of V, and it's just n by n matrices. Okay. And again, later it will be generalized to arbitrarily algebras, and then. The claim is that C infinity of M with values in G, so basically maps from the manifold to the automorphisms of the fiber of the vector space, induce an action on one form's on M with values in the Lie algebra. Sorry, do not induce an action. Act. These things act on these. And here is how the action is defined. So if you have a one form with values in G and an automorphism of the fiber, which depends on the point, then you map A to what I would call A up G, and last time I declared that it is G inverse AG plus G inverse DG, and these formulas, at least to me when I first saw them, that was maybe when I was first year graduate student, looked kind of horrible, but on the other hand, if you look at them, there's only one way to interpret them that makes sense. So that's the way that you should interpret them. But you have to stare at them a little bit to convince yourself that there is only one way to interpret those formulas so that they make sense. Okay? And then I said, where did this formula come from? And this is still not philosophy, but more mathematical. So the statement is that whenever you have an operator V-valued functions to V-valued differential forms, this group G tilde acts on that operator. In other words, the group G tilde acts on the set of such operators by mapping any operator to the operator you will get by conjugating by G. More precisely, well, G acts on sections, and G acts also on one forms. I mean, in both cases by the obvious action of G on V. So you can get an action on operator by first acting here, then applying the old operator, then applying the action inverse. Okay? So that's point one to observe. And point two to observe is that given a one form with values in the Lie algebra, it defines an operator of that type. Let's call it disobey. So to tell you what the operator is, I have to tell you how it acts on S's, where S is an element here. So S is a V-valued function. So by definition, you declare that dA of S is dS, which is a V-valued one form, plus A multiplied by S. But A in itself was a one form with values in matrices, so I can multiply it by a vector and I get a one form, so it makes sense to add. And that's dA sub S. And then what explains this formula is that it comes from the obvious formula when you use Z's operators. In other words, the operator corresponding to a one-form A, actually maybe from this point on I should call these one-forms by what everybody calls them, so I suppose I will call them connections. So you look at the differential operator corresponding to a connection, you act on it via a thing G. Maybe I should call these things by what they're standardly named. So these are gauge transformations. And then, again, you act by a gauge transformation on the differential operator in the obvious way, in the way stated here, and the claim is that what you get is the differential operator corresponding to this connection. And that's what induces the action of gauge transformations on connections. So far, all of this is verifiable mathematics, which was stated on the blackboard and now last time, and now the philosophy. So where is it coming from? So, or why do we care about it? So let me answer in several languages. So first of all, in the physics language, I write it as a general principle. So physics should be gauge invariant. And I want to explain what this means. So first of all, so the basic point is that when you talk about field theory, you have fields. So you have quantities that depend on a point in space. Space being the manifold. So this is where we live. Okay? And for example, the electric and magnetic fields. So for every point in space, you have vectors that describe the electric field and the magnetic field. And in fact, that's actually a lie because it's a bad example for a gauge theory because the electric and magnetic fields are somehow derived quantities, they're not the fundamental ones. But I'm having a hard time finding a good example where you can see the fundamental quantity right away. So pretend that it's electric and magnetic field, and you know, if you ever learn about E&M, you'll have to amend it a little bit. It's the, okay? So you have fields that depend on the point. And the basic kind of point or the basic discovery of physics in this matter is that there isn't a way to compare between the values of fields at different points. So, you know, if you have, if this is M, and above this point you have some vector fields of vector space of possible values of fields, and above this point there is some other vector space. Sorry, there is a vector space of possible values of fields. There shouldn't be a direct way to compare these values. It doesn't make sense to ask, is the field here stronger than here, or is this one stronger than here? Okay. And the way physicists would say it is to say that physics should be somehow invariant under independent transformations, where you transform this space independently from that space. Okay. When I taught this class last time, which was 12 years ago, it was in Israel, and shortly after, or not so shortly, but sufficiently shortly after the period of hyperinflation in Israel. And at the time, and it was still fresh in people's memory. So pretend that you live in Israel and hyperinflation was not so long ago, then there is a wonderful analogy, okay? And the analogy is, so what's hyperinflation? Hyperinflation is when the price of bread doubles every couple months, okay? But it actually doesn't, you know, you would think everybody would die very quickly, right? Because you cannot buy bread anymore. But that's false, because the wages also double every month. Okay, salaries also double every month. Everything is somehow inflation adjusted. Okay? So, you know, for Israelis in the 80s, during this hyperinflation time, it was completely obvious that it doesn't make sense to compare the price of bread today with the price of bread 2 years from now, 2 months from now. I mean, you just don't ask these questions. These are meaningless questions. Okay? So, okay? What you do ask is, you find some, You do ask these questions, but only after qualifying them, after saying, here is the system in which I use in order to compare. Okay? And the system, this system is what you would normally call A in this language, and the system typically in Israel would have been the so-called... basically this sort of inflation adjustment. So, I mean, there would be some index of what, there was an index of how much inflation there was based on some average of many different prices of many different things. And it would be something like 10% a month. Or I think at the worst times it got to several dozens of percents a month. But sort of some numbers of percents a month, and then you would say, let's take the price of bread 2 months from now, deduct the inflation rate times the number of months that have passed, and, I mean, appropriately computed, okay? And now we can compare the price of bread, okay? Except that there wasn't just one such index. There was some standardized index, but there were other indices to be used in other places depending on what you were interested in. Okay, there was the housing index. There was adjustment to the US dollar, which was sort of pretend, which was much more, which had much lesser inflation. Okay, so somehow it was obvious to everybody that, first of all, prices, so numbers, don't make sense on their own. And second, that to make sense of numbers, to see if you made money in a certain year or if your cost of living has actually grown or not, you had to choose a connection. You had to choose a way to compare the fibers of the sort of value bundle at one point in time with the fibers on the value bundle on another point of time. I don't know, I hope it made sense, but sort of this was reality. I mean, I lived through this reality. It really had a meaning. Okay? You know, I mean, equally well, I could have said economy, you know, economy should somehow be index independent, gauge invariant, whatever. Okay? So the claim is that the same holds for physics in general, and you know, I don't have an a priori justification for this claim. It's an experimental fact. Okay, the fact is that physics is gauge invariant. Okay. Okay. So what does it mean? It means that. You know, if you have sort of this bundle of fields above every point, and here I'm choosing a trivialization of it, it means that I should not be taking the trivialization too seriously. I should not be just different. So if you look at a field, which is just a section of this bundle, okay, I should not be differentiating S in a straightforward way. It shouldn't make sense. Okay, rather I should be talking only about things and actions and derivatives and whatever that are whose behavior under gauge transformations I understand. Now, what are gauge transformations? These are precisely elements of this group. Okay, you recalibrate the set of fields above every point independently, and that's its Lie algebra. Okay? Sorry. No. This is just the group. I'm sorry. This is... Okay. Now, if you still want to compare between fields at different times... at different points, you first have an adjustment procedure. A way to... compare the two. You have to choose arbitrarily a way to compare the fibers above one point and above a second point. And that's exactly what this A does. Or A is this infinitesimal way of comparing between neighboring fibers. So, for every point in the manifold, and I'm talking about a one form, so in any choice of direction, I get an element of the Lie algebra, so I get an infinitesimal rotation of that fiber, okay? Which amounts to saying that when I will differentiate a fiber going in the direction of a certain tangent vector, I will first of all rotate the values assuming the fiber was written using the silly trivializations that I've chosen, the unnatural trivializations that I've chosen, I will first rotate the fiber as specified by A, and only then differentiate. And this amounts to saying that you act on a fiber, on a section, or that the derivative of a section will be, well, the ordinary derivative plus a certain amount, plus however much you needed to rotate it. Okay? Sorry, I mean, I hope you, please complain. I mean, does it make sense? Does it make sense? People are smiling. Is it silly? Okay. And then again, everything should be I should be aware of how things change when I change the trivialization, when I change what I consider normal, and when I change what is considered normal, sections change in an obvious way by multiplication by an element of G, And connections, meaning adjustment systems, change well as indicated. Okay, but and the reasoning should also be clear. Okay. And then the real statement of physics is that every Lagrangian that I will write will have to be gauge invariant. Every observable that I will try to measure will have to be gauge invariant, namely invariant under the action of this group. Okay? Now, how do you make gauge invariant observables? So, well, the simplest way is to make the observable, how do you make gauge invariant Lagrangians? So the simplest way is to make Lagrangians that depend only on the connection. And then think about the actual fields only later. So the most basic thing is to make Lagrangians that depend only on A. Now, how do you make something gauge invariant under A? Remember that there is an action of the gauge group on the A's themselves. So, you know, that's a sort of, how should I say it? You spend some time, you study, and rather than telling you what is the collection of all gauge invariant things that you can construct out of an A, I'll give examples. So the most simple example is the so-called curvature of A. So the curvature of A comes from the following thing. So if you have two tangent vectors, you can identify the fiber above, if you have two tangent vectors, they sort of define a small parallelogram, and then you can identify the fiber, and then the connection A tells you how to identify the fiber above this point with the fiber above this point, and also how to identify the fiber above this point with the fiber above this point. Right? These are the evaluations of the connection on this tangent vector and on this tangent vector. And then you can ask yourself, suppose I identify this fiber with that one, and then this one with that one, and then this one with that one, and then this one with that one, do I come back to where I started? And the failure of coming back to where you started is what's called the curvature, and it can be written by a completely explicit formula. It's dA plus A wedge A. And in fact, it is not quite gauge invariant in itself, but rather it has a very clear behavior under gauge transformations. So if you look at the curvature of the transformed connection, it will be the curvature conjugated by G. So therefore, a trace of the curvature is gauge invariant, and much of real physics comes from taking this as the Lagrangian, or variants of this. So looking at, FA, wedge FA, and then taking the trace, or things like that. It's not what we will do, but I'm only stating an example. Okay? And I think that's all I wanted to say about sort of philosophy coming from physics. And then I want another bit of philosophy which is more mathematical. So here is the math bit of philosophy. So, you know, if you remember when we were talking about linking numbers and getting them from quantum field theory, we were looking at the integral of e to the I, the integral of A wedge dA, where A was an ordinary one form, not matrix valued one form, times the integral over one curve of A, times the integral of another curve of A, and that was the linking number. Okay?
And then that expression was a bit sick, because the quadratic form in the Gaussian here was degenerate. So, well, if you look at the space of all A's, there was an action of some group under which the Lagrangian was invariant, and therefore with Gaussian integration didn't quite make sense. Okay? So mathematically, mathematically the trouble was that this was not invertible. The quadratic form here was not invertible. The fact that it came because of an action was part of the cure, because it meant that instead of integrating over all A's, we could choose a section and integrate over the section. And then we did some things and it worked. Okay? But, so basically we could, the point was that we could cure this integral because, or thanks to some invariance. Okay? And then, if we will want to generalize this, so, I don't know, suppose instead of looking at A being a one form, we will want to replace A by a matrix valued one form and still write the integral of A wedge dA. Okay? Then, so again, this will be in the exponential and we will, I mean, so if we will want to cure, to generalize this, it will still be sick for the same reasons as before, and then, namely, it would still be degenerate, but then if we have any hope to cure it, we should somehow generalize it in a way that will be gauge invariant. So we should, or which will be invariant under the action of some group, and this is the group that naturally comes to mind. Okay? So, basically we want to see if we can go from here to here, where A, instead of being scalar values, it becomes matrix values, valued, and do it in such a way that that the result will still be gauge invariant. Now, if you look at the thing written here right now, it is not gauge invariant. So if you take A and replace it by G inverse AG plus G inverse DG, well, you just plug it in here and you find that it isn't gauge invariant. So the idea is maybe we could add something to fix it. Okay? So add something which in some sense is smaller, but will still fix the gauge invariant issues, and then we're sort of in game to play the game of before. Okay? So indeed that's what we will do. We will add this. Okay? And likewise for the observable. So if you remember, we also needed to know that this was gauge invariant. So we also needed to know that if you take A and replace it by A plus DF, the observable, the integral over gamma 1, doesn't change. And this had to do with the fact that gamma 1 was closed and that DF is exact. Okay? Again, this fails if A is matrix valued. Because if you take A and, well, you just check that if you replace A by this formula, then this is not gauge invariant. So the idea will be to replace this by something else. I will call it the holonomy along gamma of A, and then the result will be gauge invariant, and we will be able to play the game of before. Sorry, I hope I don't know. I'm philosophy is well, I don't know.
I'm doing my best, and probably if you've heard a real physicist talk about it, then what I said sounds like, well, sounds laughable. Okay. So, having said all this, you know, I'm only left with defining the two quantities that appear here. So, first one is just a declaration. So, definition, the Chern-Simons form of a connection A. So, now A belongs to omega 1 of, so 1 forms on R3 with values in n by n matrices. And in fact, equally well, I could replace it by 1 forms on an arbitrary 3-dimensional manifold with values in an arbitrary finite-dimensional metrized Lie algebra. Finite-dimensional, you know, Lie algebra, you know, metrized is the same as what metrized means on Mondays. Okay? So, definition, the Chern-Simons form of A is the following. So maybe I'll first do the R3 definition and then tell you how to generalize. So it's the integral over R3 of the trace of A wedge dA plus, well, not surprising, 2/3 A wedge A wedge A. End of story. And let's see what it means. A is a 1 form, dA is a 2 form. The wedge product should be a 3 form, but it's a 3 form that spits as an output 2 matrices. One matrix coming from A and one matrix coming from dA. So in other words, if temporarily you call this the Lie algebra, then it's a 3 form with values in G tensor G. It gives you 2 matrices as an output. Okay? But then, if you're thinking about matrices, you just multiply the 2 matrices and take the trace, and you got a number, so you get a numerical valued 3 forms, so it makes sense to integrate it. Okay? If you were thinking in terms of arbitrary Lie algebras, this operation of multiplying 2 matrices and taking the trace is exactly the metric, is what defined the metric on GLN. So on an arbitrary Lie algebra, you'll just use the metric. In other words, there is a functional from here to the ground field, it's, you know, what we called on Monday is the metric, and what we call today, the trace. Okay? And then the second part, so A wedge A wedge A is again a 3 form. It's valued in G tensor G tensor G. Okay? And if we are talking about matrix valued 1 forms, so we just have 3 matrices here, we multiply them and take the trace. Okay? If we are talking about an arbitrary Lie algebra, well, how do we get a scalar out of this? Well, we actually did that also. Okay? So you take the bracket of 2 of them and take the inner product with the third. So this is really the bracket, sorry, the inner product of the first argument with the bracket of the remaining two. Now, why is it sort of justified or why does this generalizes multiplication and taking the trace? Answers? So basically the point is that there is some anti-symmetry automatically coming from taking the wedge. So multiplying all three and then taking the trace is the same as first taking the commutator of the last two and then multiplying, and so basically you know what, no, I leave it, okay? But I think there is a factor of 1/2. Or you know what, should I I think I'll just leave it as such. Okay, and then there is a claim, and I will also leave it as an exercise, though later I will come back to it and do a part of it. So exercise, this really is gauge invariant. So the Chern-Simons form of A acted on by G is equal to just the Chern-Simons form of A. And I've nothing good to say about this exercise. You basically solve it by substituting the action into the Lagrangian and using everything you know about D and about integration by parts and whatever. Okay? And later I will do a second part of it. So, sorry, I hope you will forgive me. And the second thing I need to generalize is this integral along gamma 1 of A. And again, here it is. So the idea is the following. So I have a path in my manifold, right? This path is gamma 1, or my knot. And in fact, later it will be closed, but initially I don't need it to be closed, okay? So above each point on this path, there is a vector space of potential values for the fields. And given a connection, the connection tells me how to identify a point here with a point here, with a nearby point. So if these are infinite, if these two points are infinitesimally close, the connection tells me how to identify the value of bread here with the value of bread here. And how to compare, or basically how to identify a point here with a point here. And then I can identify a point here with a point in the next space, and then with the next space. And the idea is that the holonomy along the path gamma of a connection A should be this overall identification, should be a map from the fiber here to the fiber here. Now, in our particular overly simplified case, the fibers are both the same vector space. So it will be just an endomorphism of that vector space, but it will tell us how to identify things measured at this point with things measured at that point. Okay? But what should be the defining, or how should I make it precise? What should be the defining property of the holonomy? So basically,
given a path gamma in our manifold, and given an initial point over here, so call it V0, so and given V0 inside the vector space, we seek, so I seek this whole sequence of values, this whole chain of values, the value here, the value here, the value here, the value here, so I seek a path, gamma tilde, which is a path inside the fiber. I mean, generally speaking, it will be, I mean, for general vector bundles, it will be a section of the bundle. But again, for us, it, I can just have to say, I just need a map into V, such that from the perspective of the connection A, this path appears to be constant. Okay, so if I differentiate with this A adjustment, this path should be constant. And then the holonomy will be the value of the path at the endpoint. Okay? So basically, so I mean, I could write it this way. If you take the connection A and pull it back to just the path, and then use it to differentiate the section, it should appear constant. So it should appear zero. Or if you want to write it more formally, I write it as follows. So if you take the naive derivative of gamma tilde and add to it what you need to add to adjust. So you add to it A evaluated each time along the tangent to the path. So you add to it A evaluated on gamma dot at the point T, then you should get zero. So again, A is a one form. If I evaluate it as on a tangent vector, I get well, it's a one form with values of values in matrices. So I'll get a matrix, and matrix I can apply to vectors, and I want this to be zero. Yes?
Is gamma tilde the parallel transport?
Yes. I am defining parallel transport. Sorry. Sorry, I don't know. I hope it makes sense. The point is, well, okay, not the point, but next, I actually want a formula for gamma tilde. And I'll write the formula, and then I'll give you several reasons why it's true. Okay? So, claim, at least perturbatively, gamma tilde is the following. So, so gamma tilde as a function of t is the identity. Sorry. So I'm going to write a big matrix, and this matrix should be applied to the vector v0. First of all, I should be applying the identity matrix, and then I should be looking at the integral from 0 to t ds. Or ds1, A evaluated on gamma dot of s1. And then I should add the integral over all possible choices of s1 smaller than s2 between 0 and t of A evaluated on gamma dot s2 times A evaluated on gamma dot S1, and that's it. And then I should be subtracting the integral over S1 less than S2 less than S3, all between 0 and T, of a similar thing and continue. Okay? So, first of all, what does it mean? Well, this is the identity matrix, we know what it means. Well, A was a matrix valued one form. If I evaluate it on a tangent vector, I will get a matrix, which I can then integrate. Just take, and the result is again a matrix. So I again got a matrix, and I can apply it to V0. Here, I integrate over all possible ways of choosing two points. For each point, I get A evaluated on a tangent vector, so I get two matrices. I multiply them, then I integrate. And so on. Okay? Sorry, and I should have said it, this is true for small a. Okay? Or, you know, if you really want to be precise, you know what? Maybe I don't want to be precise, but, okay, first of all, intuitively, why is it true? So, intuitively, if a is small, okay, if A was zero, then no adjustments are needed. V0 goes to V0, I just take the identity matrix. If A is small, then, basically, A occasionally kicks V0 to move somewhere. Okay? If A is small, then, I can figure out what happens to V0 by sort of counting the kicks. So if it kicks V0 only once, I'll get the part of the result that's as big as A. If it kicks V0 twice, I'll get the quadratic contribution to the result. So the part of the result that's proportional to A squared. Or to the size of A squared. And then there would be a part that in which A kicks V0 three times, and that would be the term appearing here, and so on. And then you can, and then it's kind of clear that the first kick, the part that's proportional to the size of A, is when A kicks in at any point along the way, that's this integral ds1, and then the amount by which it kicks is the tangent vector evaluated on A. Okay? So, that's the intuition, at least my intuition. And if you want a proof, so here is a better proof. So, let's first of all call the quantity inside here, so without the V0, so that's a matrix. Let's call it the holonomy along gamma of A at time t. So this in itself is an endomorphism, so it's a matrix. And then the claim is that if you differentiate with respect to t, the holonomy along gamma of A at t, so basically it's an exercise in calculus. When you differentiate it with respect, when you differentiate the identity with respect to t, you get zero. When you differentiate an integral with respect to t, you get the integrand at the end point. Okay? So you get the identity times the integrand at the end point, which is oops, my notes say something wrong. Which is A of gamma dot at the point T. But with a minus sign, I suppose. If you integrate the next one, Oh, but sorry, I guess the identity commutes with this, so I could have written the A on the left. So it's A at gamma dot of T times the identity. If you integrate the next one, then again it's the fundamental theorem of calculus, but again, differentiate. So if I differentiate this with respect to T, the contribution I get is the contribution coming from the place where S2 is fixed to be T. If S2 is fixed to be T, you get A of gamma dot at T times, you still have the S1 integral, which is the same as what you had of the previous term. So you will get I minus the integral from 0 to T ds1 A of gamma dot of S1. And then it will continue. So basically, the derivative with respect to T of each term is the previous term multiplied on the left by this quantity. So overall, the holonomy, the derivative of the holonomy satisfies is minus A of gamma dot at T times the holonomy itself. But this just says that the holonomy satisfies the differential equation, satisfies a differential equation similar to this one. So if you take the holonomy and multiply it by V0, so if you set gamma tilde to be the holonomy multiplied, acting on V0, it will satisfy precisely this differential equation. And I am over time, so I think I'll stop. And thanks for your attention.